Session number 26580.
Wing Commander Roberts, Reel 7. Now, I believe there's some other stories from your time at Gibraltar as a squadron.
Well, certainly one I missed, and that is that there were several trophies awarded in Coastal Command. And after I'd taken control of 224 Squadron, they won the trophy. And in those days, the Coastal Command reunion in Northwood is still going on today, but it's a much lesser affair than it used to be. And one went up to Coastal Command, wore evening dress, and I was presented with this trophy by the CNC in front of a vast crowd of people in evening dress. It doesn't happen anymore. It's much, much, much smaller. But it was an interesting occasion always, because you met staff officers of command and squadron commanders of other squadron commanders.
And this was awarded for what exactly?
I can't remember what that particular one was awarded for. There was a gunnery and bombing award, which I can't remember the name of it now, which is still awarded these days. But I think that particular award was awarded for general performance. And Gibraltar had an edge, of course, because the weather was much better.
The station was reorganised when you got a new station commander. Did that make any difference?
Well, I think I told you.
Is that already mentioned? Right.
Well,
sorry.
Except there's another little matter, which is almost unique, I think, in wartime post-war history. That station commander insisted that he and I and the chief of the maintenance people carried sticks. You know? Leather-bound sticks under our arms.
Why?
Well, I suppose to indicate we were commanding officers. I thought it was a jolly good idea. But I've never seen it anywhere else at all. But it was a remnant of pre-war. Because he was a Cranwell boy.
You also acted as air advisor during a paper exercise, an army paper exercise. Do you recall much of that?
Yes, that was very strange. I thought I was appointed to be the air advisor to a paper exercise for all the army officers in Gibraltar, and nothing happened. I can't remember whether I got the papers, I think, setting the scene, but nothing else happened. I wasn't invited to any meetings or anything like that. And then I was invited to the wash up, where I suppose there were probably 40 or 50 officers sitting on the floor. And the brigadier, the governor, and me, humble me, on a platform, you know, looking down on all these chaps. And so the various syndicates said what their solutions were and what have you. And then, to my absolute horror and panic, the brigadier turned to me and asked me if I had any comments. Oh, dear me. Fortunately, something happened, and I was able to say a few words. Which then got me a little note from the AOC, or at least from the brigadier, through the AOC, saying thank you very much, which was very nice, and probably stood me in good stead for the future.
Now, so anything else before we move on? Your next one was to the airmen.
There is a comment which I must make here. Having finished with Canada and perhaps the interviewing interlude, the next years until the end of my career, all my postings were abbreviated. In other words, in the same time, I got a hell of a lot more experience in than most RAF officers. I was posted from Gibraltar after only 18 months there, when a normal tour would be 2.5 years, but after only 18 months, simply because the post was upgraded to Wing Commander, and they wouldn't give me an acting rank, so I had to go. And I was posted to Air Ministry in maritime operations, which was again very interesting and of course useful career wise to be at that elevated position and a broad view of life.
You were there for just under a year, 10 months, from May 55 to March 56.
Well, no, that's not quite true. My time in maritime operations was curtailed insofar as we had a group captain and a deputy director, and we had a director who also looked after navigation people. And that director, Air Commodore, was appointed to command Christmas Island Affair. And I met him one day walking up from the station to work, and he said, would you be able to go away for a year? And I said, well, I'll let you know in the morning. And I did. And I was whipped out of maritime operations to take part in Operation Grapple.
Right, we're going to come on to that, but let's stick it. You seem, while you were actually there, for the short period you were there, you seem to have been dealing a lot with the new equipment. Now, do you remember much about this? Various navigation devices, sonar equipment, and various other things.
One kept a watch on what the technical people were doing. It was necessary to, you know, for them not to operate in a vacuum, otherwise the things became impractical or couldn't fit or something like that. But there was green satin, which was a Doppler navigation equipment, I think. Orange Harvest, which was a directional finder for radar, I think, if I remember rightly.
So did you really understand these devices then?
Yes.
So you understood the technical basis?
Oh, not about the technical basis, no. I mean, one understood what they were meant and what they were meant to do and how they operated without knowing the technical background.
Now, so the next thing would be when you went to headquarters Task Force Grapple at the Air Ministry, and that according to your book, and your list anyway, was April 56.
Yes, I think probably right.
And you were there till the February 57. Now, could you explain the background to what were you doing with the headquarters before you were sent out, i.e. at the Air Ministry?
Oh, yeah, well, my job, there were very great shortage of officers to start with, and I started off in what was really like a ballroom with glass chandeliers, which was really part of the air board accommodation, which we are able to operate in occasionally, or most of the time. And in that enormous room, there were three officers. There were two army majors, one at RASC, and one was an infantryman, and I'm not too sure what he was doing. And there was me, and I was concerned with the organisational part of the RAF of Grapple, formation and numbers of people.
Personnel,
and then to choosing or getting the right people posted to the organisation.
So you were in selection of personnel.
Yes.
Was there anything in particular you were looking for, or just good officers?
Well, what happened was that all the chaps on Task Force Grapple, were first class chaps. And they all knew people who were very good people. So when they wanted a squadron leader to do so and so and so, they said, oh, well, yeah, I know Joe. And you ring up Joe, do you mind going away for a year? No, right. So he's whipped into the organisation. You see, we always had a first class priority. Nobody had a higher priority for anything than Grapple. Even Suez operation, which went on down below us at one stage, only achieved the same priority. We could do anything, we could have anything.
And in fact, that's how you'd been recruited.
Well, I was invited to...
Same way?
Yes.
Now, what There seems to be some work on establishing a warning system of leaflets and this is before you go out there.
One of the jobs which came my way was to how one would warn ships that they were entering a forbidden area. In other words, it was a safety business, because we didn't want people anywhere near nuclear weapons going off. Either for security purposes or for their own safety. And I put my mind to this. Now, in the Shackleton, there is not, or there wasn't, a searchlight for illuminating submarines at night. But what they produced was a battery of super very lights, which were white. And you could set them off in sequence. So as you approached a target, these lights would be going off, boom, 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 and illuminating the area. And I thought, well, now, if we could do that, fly across the front of a ship, and using red ones, it'd be a good idea. So somebody made the request, the red ones were made. But also, it also was necessary to tell the ship why they were being stopped. And so, we're also dropping a flare parachute loaded with leaflets. And I had to get these leaflets organized in several languages, including Japanese, Chinese, Swedish, Norwegian, French. That's about it as far as I can remember.
Were you made aware at this stage of the purpose of the tests and what was going on, or were you working somewhat in the dark yourself?
No. The number of weapon tests, the type of weapons, anything about them was a matter of top secret. It was top secret, even to the staff, except those engaged in it.
So you just knew there were going to be tests? You didn't know anything more?
Oh, we knew there were going to be weapon tests, nuclear weapon tests, yes.
But that's all?
Yes.
And there was a leak, or it appears it wasn't a leak, from Chapman
Finch.
Can you tell us, because that's quite interesting, I mean, what exactly happened?
Well, I only know what happened by reading Chapman Finch's book.
How did you see it at the time?
Oh, well, the whole staff were up in arms. They thought there'd been a great leak of...
Why? What happened?
Well, because Chapman Pincher put a headline on the what was it, Daily Express, that there were going to be four tests, I think he said, in June or whenever, I can't remember what it was. But it turned out that, in fact, this had been instigated by the task force commander, as a security device to persuade anyone who was coming to Christmas Island that the time was different from what it was going to be. But only the task force commander hadn't told anybody. He'd arranged it with Chapman Pinch and, I suppose, other security people.
So you were all wondering where the leak came from?
Oh, no, we were all furious.
Now, anything else about your time before you went out there? Because you went out there in February... 57.
That's right.
Anything else about the ministry before you went out there?
I don't know. One interesting point, nothing to do with grapple, was that we moved down underneath the Air Ministry in Whitehall, and on the floor above us, which was still below ground, I discovered, only because I met a chap who I knew in Canada, that they were busy planning Suez, which again, of course, was a top secret operation. But Teddy Hamilton and I met walking along Whitehall, and I discovered that was what was going on.
But you didn't know other than that?
No. Don't think so.
So he'd broken security?
Well, I probably, yes.
So you then went out with Task Force Grapple and the staff of Task Force Grapple to Christmas Island.
Yes, we flew to New York and transferred on a very cold, snowy day to the old... these names keep disappearing, you see. We landed at what then was Idlewild and moved across to the first airfield in New York, which was the domestic setup. We got on board a United Airlines DC-6, I think, and flew to Chicago, where I got the fright of my life, because we came round on a left-hand circuit. And as we were turning into land, I was looking out to the port side, and there was an aircraft coming towards me turning into land on the same runway. I didn't know, however, that there were parallel runways, so it was all right. We then went on to, flew on to Omaha, and from Omaha we flew on to Denver, and then on to San Francisco, where I think we had to cruise around a bit because of a bit of a lot of sea fog around there. I can't remember how long we were there, a day or two. When we all herded into a constellation of Qantas, who flew us to Hawaii and then onto the island. The island being about 1,200 miles almost due south of Honolulu and about 2 degrees north from the equator. The biggest island, the biggest atoll in the Pacific, about 35 miles long, I think. And
so what was the situation when you got out there? What was the setup of Operation Grapple? What was the personnel? How was it organised?
Well, of course, I knew from being in Air Ministry that one of the greatest things that was done there was to create a brand. This Christmas Island was used by the Americans during the war. So there was a runway there. But unfortunately, the runways were got coconut plants growing up through the tarmac. This we knew because while I was in maritime ops, I'd been asked to write a paper on how these islands could be reconnoitred, without my being told the purpose, of course. And so Coastal Command sent out three Shackletons operating from, I can't remember, the most northwest of the Line Islands, of which Christmas Island is one, which has got an international airport. And the Shackletons landed at Christmas Island and landed at Aitutaki, much further south. I think it was Aitutaki. I can't remember these names these days. And came back with the gen. Now that immediately produced a big effort from the Royal Engineers, who produced a brand new modern runway, 2,000 yards, on Christmas Island. Interesting indication of our priorities. Do you know what a Barber Green machine is? A Barber Green machine is one of these machines you see on the road breathing flames and laying down new tarmac, right? And I think two or three of those were being loaded on a ship in London Dock, and one fell over the side into the water. Well, inside 2 days, there have been Navy divers there, and it was back on the ship. That's the sort of priority. No nonsense, it must be done now. Anyway, they produced this beautiful runway and laid out tented camp, and there were one or two wooden buildings, which are like task force headquarters, and there was a sick quarters, of course.
Now, how many were there of you?
Oh, including people on Navy ships, probably about 5,000, I think. Including two women. The engineers built a special building for them, a special accommodation for them, with the only hot water on the island, by producing roof heaters, you know, from the sun, solar heaters from the sun. But they were welfare women.
Now, what was the work you were doing?
Well, on Christmas Island, I became one of the operations controllers. And I gave the briefing for each of the operations.
How did you prepare it, and what was in the briefing?
Well, each individual aircraft crew were briefed on their own speciality. They had a role to play, and they were completely briefed on that. So all I had to do was put the whole operation together, so that everybody knew what everybody else was doing. So I learned a lesson, because on the first briefing I gave, Task Force Commander called me over and said, look, you must stop looking out of the window so much. But I was, concentrating. So I learned a lesson.
Was that a practice briefing?
It was the first, which was a practice operation, yes. But I learned a lesson then, that when speaking to a crowd of people, you must distribute, the directions in which you are. It's a useful lesson.
And I believe there's a lot of problems about the weather, and you had Shackleton's out.
Well, I don't think there's any problems about the weather.
You say in the book it was as bad as the decision made before D-Day.
Oh, that was the second occasion. That was the second weapon, that was.
Okay, I see what you mean.
That was the second weapon. But in the middle of the Pacific, one had to get some weather information. And we had Canberras to do high-level recce, and the Shackletons used to do a 12-hour sortie every day, I think, over a certain, and an ascent up to 18,000, and over a particular route, so that the Met men could draw up some weather charts.
You seem to have been working very long hours as well. What exactly? I mean, what were you doing in all the time?
Well, one was on watch in the ops room. One had stood a watch in the ops room.
What would you be doing on watch?
That's a good question. I can't remember. Well, I mean, I did 90 hours a week in the ops room, but some of that was a sleeping watch.
Now, what exactly were the tests? What were you doing?
Well, the weapon, experimental weapon, was loaded onto a Valiant.
And what was it? Do you know which variant of bomb?
Well, it would be a hydrogen weapon. But I can't go any more than that.
So they'd load it onto a
Valiant? It was a fusion rather than a fission weapon. And then that Valiant would then, before the whole operation was this, that there was a prediction of whether if there was a fallout area, right? In other words, after the weapon went, which was meant to burst at about 6,000 or 8,000 feet, if it hit the ground and burst, there would be a lot of debris thrown up, and so one had to search a possible fallout area, so as to, if there was anybody in it, the operation stopped. So we had four Shackletons go. The first thing was to predict the fallout area by the Met people. And then four Shackletons were tasked to search that area to start with. There was a weather flight went out. Valiant went out and did some racetrack before dropping the weapon. There was a photographic camera, I think. There were cloud samplers who flew through the cloud afterwards. So there was quite a circus of aircraft.
That sounds a risky job. I mean, was radiation really understood at the time?
Absolutely. There was no doubt about that. When the sampling aircraft had been through the cloud, they came back and landed and went to a certain area where the machine was completely hosed down, completely sensitized, I suppose. Well, I can't, another word gone. But the whole thing was completely washed down. The crew got out, and they were completely washed down, stripped, and washed down. So there was absolutely no danger. This island where the drop was 400 miles away from Christmas Island. So there was absolutely no danger whatsoever of anybody on Christmas Island being contaminated. There was a plan that if the aircraft crashed on takeoff, what everybody would have to do. There was a positive plan of dispersal around the airfield, around the island or what have you, so as to get out of the fallout area. It was a beautifully planned operation. Marvellous task force commander, who didn't achieve the rank he deserved after that, I don't think.
Now, what about the first test? How did that go? No problems?
There were no problems as far as everybody is concerned, except the scientists.
In what way?
Oh, I don't know. Top secret information.
But they weren't happy?
We didn't learn that until after the third drop. We suddenly discovered they were going to have to do some more tests. The planned operation of grapple was for 3 tests.
So, what was the problem with the second test?
The intertropical front. I don't know whether you're aware of the intertropical front, but it is a weather phenomenon which moves north and south over the equator during the year. And on that occasion, it was just over the island. And deposited so much rain that stores were flooded and roads were flooded. An awful mess.
But the test went on.
Yes. But I say that the briefing, which was done at about 4 o'clock in the morning, I think just like the war test for the invasion of Europe, the information was presented, you know, particularly the amount of cloud and what have you, and the weather at both places, and the task force commander decided to go, where I might have said no.
But all was well.
Well, yes, I mean, that showed how good a man he was.
Anything else about the tests that you recall?
I don't think so. I did at least one sortie in a Shackleton weather trip. I did 2 or 3 sorties down to Maldon Island, the target island in the Dakota flight.
Maldon?
Maldon.
M-A-L-D-E-N.
That was about 400 miles south-southeast of Christmas Island. And there was a carrier, a naval carrier, just off that place. And they had ducks. You know a duck, D-U-K-S? To go between there and, not the carrier, but they had a converted tank landing craft. I went down to the island, was taken in a helicopter across to the tank landing craft, and I went back in a duck the next morning, I think.
What did you see at Maldon Island? I mean, what could you see?
It was just flat. Just flat. Nothing there. About, you know, only a few feet, perhaps a bit more, above sea level.
But it was the
size of a triangle, with about 2 mile sides or something, 2-3 mile sides.
And no radiation risk as far as you were
concerned. No.
So, anything else before
you
left?
What happened was, well, immediately after each test, the scientists went back onto Maldon, you know, with the proper safety suits and everything like that, just to make sure there was nothing there, and there never was.